Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to make an accordion or a bowie knife or a boat with one's own hands? And what is the value of bypassing modern manufacturing methods? With his business slow at the height of the Great Recession, photographer Tad Myers decided to spend a bit of time on a passion project. He planned to travel around Texas, documenting the work of artisans making consumer goods the way their grandparents might have done, slowly, in small quantities, and with a fierce dedication to quality. As it happened, Myers kept going even after his commercial work picked back up and continued for nearly 5 years, going all over the country to meet and photograph people who make things the old-fashioned way. The new book by Tad Myers is called Portraits of the American Craftsman. Tad, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be here.
So how did this side project grow into something much bigger than what you imagined?
Well, I guess it started from a couple of commercial projects that an editorial project to photograph a saddle maker in Fort Worth, and then Matchbox Studio in Dallas hired me to photograph Brent Hull of Hull Historical Millworks that makes historically correct moldings for houses and municipalities around the country. And so he's in Fort Worth, and they make these beautiful moldings and things for these different clients, and they're historically accurate. So it's, you know, Victorian or whatever the different time period is. And so we photographed them, and then literally on the way back from that job, shooting their craftsmen, making them for their website, those photographs, my producer and I, Shane Kislak, and I kind of worked on thinking about what maybe there's other craftsmen, other companies in America that still make things by hand. And so we did some research, and between the two of us, and he had some recommendations, and I kind of looked into it, found Nakona gloves and the first six. And Nakona gave us the Stagecoach Maker because he was so far under the radar, didn't have a website or anything. You know, it was like he was like 80-something years old at that time and kind of wrapping up his career. And so we found those first six. And then that was in the summer of 2008, and kind of worked on that and built the kind of the brand of the project and stuff. And I've done a lot of personal projects over my career, and I always push those to try and get commercial business that kind of reflects that, hopefully. And so over that next 6 months, we kind of created a website, and we made a booklet that Matchbox Studios in Dallas designed for us and made the website. And so we worked on that, and then hosted a party and mailed out 3,000 these little booklets, and that kind of kicked off the project, in which I thought that was kind of the end, probably. You know, it was this amazing kind of end to that, and, you know, this great little 20-page booklet that I made with a blind emboss envelope that Matchbox designed, and it was really beautiful. They did a great job, the website. And then, you know, had that, and then got busy with work, and it brought in multiple clients really quickly. Danner Boots that summer, doing some video and some images for them, and several nice jobs after that that were directly from that. I mean, like, we want our stuff to look just like that. And so it was a perfect fit. And it, as we started shooting those and traveling more to Tennessee and Kentucky and Connecticut and Louisiana, Colorado, California, all the different states, in the next 3 years, we continued to photograph more companies. So we'd stick around for a couple of days after the job and try and find some companies. So I was probably the main person looking for them because the criteria was kind of tight, and trying to find diverse people, both geographically and you know, what they make and what they make what they're made out of. You know, leather and wood, you don't want to have it all the same stuff, you know, metal, whatever. And so, and geographically diverse and scale, you know, one person operation all the way up to Steinway Pianos that's multiple hundreds, and Danner Boots. So, you know, it kind of grew and just kept growing. And then I got an agent, David Hale Smith, my literary agent, and, you know, pursued a publisher and found a writer, Eric Celeste, that did an amazing job in writing for me and being the author. I had to kind of give all the content to them, provide all the content to the publisher by being the author, of course, and I'm not a writer, so I wanted to partner with somebody that would really do a great job, which Eric did an amazing job, I think, on the writing. So just to keep that depth, that level of depth, and create the level of depth for a book like this was really my goal. I wanted it not just to be beautiful photographs, but also about the stories and stuff that I think, you know, are inspirational and are what people want to read as well.
Well, there are two interesting sort of subcategories here. There are the people making things that you didn't know that anybody made anymore, right? Like Hull Millworks and like the guy who makes stagecoaches and things like that. And then there are people making by hand things that we assume are always made in a gigantic factory overseas somewhere. Blue jeans and hats and things that we take for granted.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, they're all different scales and different, you know, different products. And so I guess like the jean maker, you know, a lot of the stuff's custom. A lot of those things, I mean, the knife maker in Arkansas, Jerry Fisk Knives, he makes these amazing Bowie knives in Arkansas. And, you know, they're not very inexpensive, obviously. And he's like 3 years out if you order one from him today. But, you know, they're functional art is what I call them. And it's, you know, they're items that are beautiful. And that was part of the criteria for the project is also not just geographic and different diversity things, but also items that people love and are emotionally attached to, you know, baseball gloves, hats, boots, you know, things like that, knives. I mean, things that people want as more like a functional piece of art. And so, I mean, that was a big part of why we chose these companies too. And then also legacy and, you know, like Steinway Pianos, it's been around for over 100 years and that type of thing. And then there's a lot of young guys. I mean, the pipe maker is about my age and he's slightly younger than me. Todd Johnson in Nashville, Tennessee. And he has two young kids and he's making these pipes and he's learned overseas. He went and studied with a pipe maker overseas to learn how to make these pipes in a real traditional manner. And he makes them and sells them at, you know, and it's, you know, it's just inspiring, I think, to see these people doing these things. And, you know, they don't have normal jobs. I mean, it's, you know, they get to do something like this every day. And I think it's amazing.
Well, his story, the pipe maker, is really interesting because he starts by picking out the wood. Like that's I might assume that, you know, the raw materials come in and you make your thing. But for him, the selection of the raw material really does dictate what the finished product becomes.
Yeah, I mean, he had a whole huge box of all the different pieces that he would go over. I think he got the wood from Italy, and I can't remember, it's in the book, but I can't remember all the facts. But they, you know, he would go over to Italy and pick the wood or wherever he would go, and he would select the wood, and it's all different, you know, types that are really mainly used for pipe making. And it's for different reasons. I mean, you know, there's, you know, the grain in it, the hardness of it, the different reasons to use it. And it's probably, you know, fairly exotic wood, but, you know, the feel of that and the texture and the way that those pieces are cut, and some of them are, you know, have unfinished sides, and, you know, you can't create that, artificially. You know, it's part of nature. It's part of the way it grew. And so that's what makes it unique. And that's what makes, I think it gives him, you know, gives the value to what he makes.
I was interested in how many people, in telling you their stories, got into whatever they do almost by accident or through a really unexpected route. I mean, some people, I guess, have, you know, had these businesses passed down through time. But there's the gentleman in the beginning of the book that started making banjos because he ordered a banjo and his wasn't arriving.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Chuck Lee Banjos in Ovilla. He's a character I really enjoyed working with him on that thing. It was actually a story for Garden and Gun magazine originally that they hired me for. And so I went down there and photographed him, and I just thought, wow, what an amazing addition to the book. I thought too, you know, we have a couple of luthiers, you know, the guitar maker up in Gainesville. That was one of the first ones, Vince Paulus. From the first six, and we found the banjo maker through Garden and Gun and photographed him. And he's just, I think, just a character. He's interesting. He's amazing. And so, you know, he started off, you know, he was a plumber for 20 something years or whatever throughout his career. And he, you know, wanted a banjo and wanted to find, buy a banjo, and they're not easy to find or not easily, I guess, accessible in some ways. And so, and then he looked for a book to build a banjo, and there's no book or maybe one book about how to build a banjo. So he pretty much had to start from scratch, you know, and start figuring out how to make the jigs to make the different components and the parts and what he had to, you know, buy or the types of wood. And so just through trial and error, a lot of it, and just learning how to make it, That's what got him, you know, into making those banjos. And now he's been making them for, I don't know, maybe 10 years, something like that, I believe. And that's what he does. He's not a plumber anymore. I think that's inspirational, and it's pretty amazing.
I love the story of him going home and telling his wife, I think I want to start making banjos. And she right. says, fine. And he says, no. I mean, I think I want to stop being a plumber and start making banjos. And she says, you should do it.
Yes, and he's surprised by that, you know. Hey, you know, I'm going to spend my retirement money on buying a bunch of, you know, tools to outfit a tool shop and start making these banjos and selling them. And, you know, it's a leap of faith in some ways, of course. And I guess his wife obviously knew that, you know, he was driven and had the interest in doing something like that and knew that he would succeed.
A lot of these things, I really grew an appreciation for how physically demanding they are. They take skill, they take craftsmanship, they take creativity, but they're also hard on the body.
Yeah, well, some of them, especially the larger one, the larger pieces and larger things that the companies make, have a lot more physical component to the production. I mean, you know, the carousel maker, everything is much larger, it's Carousel Works in Ohio, Mansfield, Ohio, and they make carousels. They started just kind of repairing carousels, and then over time, you know, they were asked, well, can you make us one? And so they made one for the zoo up in Washington, D.C., and so that one, if you ever go to D.C., that's their carousel. And they made one for a cruise ship, and when I was there, we were talking to them, and they had to make it, you know, make sure that it would stay level if the ship was, you know, going back and forth 5 degrees or whatever, and you know, I think it was for Carnival, so it's a major cruise line, but they put one on a ship. They had to make sure it was silenced so it wouldn't make a bunch of noise through the entire ship. So it was a major engineering change to make that happen, and they make every single part of that structure in their facility. To me, that's, I mean, you know, unfortunately today there's so many options in the world to buy parts and mm-hmm. and spokes or motors and whatever you need to build things. A lot of times people order different components and put them together, and you know, some might come from overseas, some might come from, you know, Canada or Mexico, and then some from America, but they actually create everything, all the parts, you know, in their blacksmith's shop, and they make the motors and the turbine thing that turns it and all the gears. And that to me is just amazing. Just walking around that place, I can remember. And, you know, get back to your point, the scale of that operation is amazing even in itself. And you see in the photographs in the book, a couple of them, you know, they laminate these pieces of wood together and they make these gigantic, you know, 10 by 10 foot wide or 12 by 12 foot wide boxes, basically, that are laminated wood all together. And then they have this system of measuring how deep to cut. It's like the old, you know, artists that would, like Da Vinci or whoever, would go into a marble and carve away what's not supposed to be there to create the object that's inside. And that's what they did with the carousel characters, and they have a real scientific method of doing that. They start with drawings, and then they go to the you know, making a miniature of it, and then they extrapolate that miniature up using a system. It's a very interesting and more analog system than I thought it would really be, in measuring kind of how deep to drill the holes to know how much wood to remove to get them close to where then they finish it by hand with different tools and, you know, chainsaws at the beginning all the way down to hand sanders at the end.
I love the idea of meeting somebody at like a cocktail party or a coffee shop and saying, what do you do? And hearing someone say, I'm a carousel maker. It's
yeah.
just cool.
Yeah, it's amazing.
We're speaking this hour with photographer Tad Myers. His new book is called Portraits of the American Craftsman. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. SMU.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Tad Myers about his new book of photography, Portraits of the American Craftsman. Text for the book was written by Eric Celeste. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or email the show at think@kera.org. So you've referred a couple of times to Steinway pianos, and these are really astonishing the way they come together, because this is not, it takes a long time to make a piano.
Yes, definitely. I mean, you know, we saw the full process. It's funny, over time, as we photograph more factories, I think I got better at trying to kind of figure out what's the components and what's the series of images that would tell the story the best. And, you know, it's kind of hard, because some products might take, you know, I don't know, half a day to make or something. And then some products take 2 months to make. So in the production of it and talking to them ahead of time, we try and figure out, okay, well, can you have the products at different stages for the day that we're there, so we can kind of get the full process?
Yeah.
Because that's very important to see from beginning to end. And so even like there, I remember going down to their, or going up wherever in their floor, their factory is about five or six stories, I believe. And we went to the area where they make the frames, and that's obviously the very first thing that happens, is they take these laminated boards and they take like whatever 5 or 6 or 8 of those, and they glue them together and laminate them, glue them together, and then they put them on these forms and they bend them to a form that holds them until the glue dries. So first they just kind of slide, you know, because the glue is wet, and so they bend it around it, and then once it dries after a couple days or whatever, they pull it off, and they've got, that's the form. And they have, I don't know, 6 or 8 different forms for different size pianos. And then they go in the a drying room for, I don't remember the exact time, but for a long time, where they just dry the wood out, and it's like, it's super hot and super, you know, dry in there, and it pulls out all the moisture. That's what one of my favorite images from the book is, that shot looking down into that kind of dark cave-like looking room with all of them stacked, you know, just kind of in line, and they're just sitting and they're just drying. And then there's a whole process to everything that they do. And, you know, some of the imagery of, you know, one of the guys stringing the piano, I think it's very, I don't know, like one of that image in particular, a guy stringing one of the pianos, is very artistic looking. He is almost like, it's almost like he's playing it, but he's stringing the, you know, strings onto the piano at the time that I'm shooting him. So just trying to show the different components of the way these things are made, because that's the fascinating part to me. It's almost like it's all behind the scenes photographs that no one ever sees.
12,000 individual parts in a Steinway,
yeah,
or in
right.
a piano, I guess. In
right.
A piano.
Right.
Does everybody at the factory play? Are they all musicians?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't think I really know the answer to that. I would guess that they do. I mean, or they at least know about pianos mm-hmm. or music to some degree. One of the interesting things, too, is at the end, I found it really fascinating that kind of at the end of our shoot day, we went down to where they come out of production. And I, you know, I always try and kind of start from the beginning and work through the process with them, and then go to the end and see the final product and packaging and all that, and see if that's worthy of being photographed, because sometimes that's not that great, you know, the actual packaging part, and it's real commercial looking. But what I thought really interesting is there's one guy in there, and I don't have his name on the top of my mind right now, but, you know, that's his job. He sits in a room. He's been doing it for a long, long time, and he sits in there and plays a piano, checks it, tunes it, and he's like their quality control, is this guy that sits in there and tests all the pianos to make sure that they are going out at the Steinway, you know, quality level.
You went to, is it Nashville? You went to see Manuel, the guy who has made all these glitzy costumes over the years. Nashville or Memphis?
Nashville.
So he like put Elvis in his sparkly cape.
Right.
And he put Johnny Cash all in black. Tell us about him, because he's like an institution.
Yeah, that, you know, I'd say that he is by far the most famous person in the book. You know, the most famous but non-famous person in the book, because, you know, not many people know who he is, but everyone knows who his clients are. And, you know, if you're not in that world, that one niche, kind of entertainment, kind of apparel type niche, you might not even heard of him, you know, before. But, yeah, he's been around for so long, and he was just the most interesting and fascinating person because, yeah, I mean, how often do you get to talk to the guy that put Johnny Cash in Black? I mean, that's, to me, that was just amazing. And so just being with him for a day, you know, we were up there for a job for Through the Loom, actually for the Richards Group at that time, up in Kentucky. And so we stuck around 3 days and we photographed four companies in that time, all the Kentucky and Tennessee companies in the book. And so that was probably one of the longer stints that we stuck around a place. But, you know, two in Nashville, the pipe maker and Manuel. And, you know, just being there with him was just, he's just such an icon, I think, in so many people's minds and in that industry. And the day we were there, he's making, of course, you know, I'm going, well, so what are you making today? And he says, oh, I'm making a shirt for Kid Rock. And he says, well, you know, Kid was at some hotel recently and he sent his shirt out to get cleaned and they didn't dry clean it. They laundered it. And so they destroyed the shirt and it's like a $3,000 shirt. So he was remaking that. Of course, he doesn't remake it. He's redoing it. I mean, it's a piece of art. There's only one. So he said, well, I will not make, you know, I'm not going to make the exact same one. So he changed it. And it's, you know, each shirt is unique. Each thing he makes is a piece of art. I mean, the pattern gets tossed out or whatever. I mean, I think that one he might have used some of the pattern from the old one, that whole Born Free thing with a big eagle on the back of it, you know, had a big eagle embroidered on the back that was really cool. But he, you know, he makes them all, you know, to their size, of course, and then and you know, he has total creative license. And he, you know, there's a great quote in the book, something, and I'm going to paraphrase because I don't remember exactly, but you know, he makes you what Manuel wants you to wear, you know. So you don't go to him and tell him what you want, you know, you go to him and he gives you what you need is what he says.
Years ago, I was interviewing an up and coming country star that I think kind of came and went, but she was really excited because she had just gotten her first like Manuel. I don't know if it was a jacket or a shirt or something. And she felt like she had arrived because she owned this thing.
Right. Oh, I could definitely see how that could happen. I mean, you know, it's, he is an institution. He's been around a long time. You know, his history and his past, you know, he came here a long time ago and he was from Mexico originally. And he was a very famous person working in apparel back then, you know, back when he was younger. And then he went to California, I believe, and then moved to Nashville to be closer to the more country western, I guess, or music in general, but country too. And then he's still working today.
You also went to a place where they are making like custom suits for people. And this is an interesting business because although people have been going to tailors for hundreds of years, now there's a lot of competition from factories doing bespoke suits overseas and you send your measurements in. And so they're under more time pressure now, even in this country, than they used to be.
Yeah, there's really not many American-made suit makers left. I mean, there really isn't. And luckily, you know, Oxford came to me as a project, actually, as a job first. And so they're one of the very few people in the or companies featured in the book that were actually from a job. I mean, in fact, I made it a point that I didn't want anyone in the book to pay to be in the book because I wanted complete creative license to just either nix them if I didn't like them or if I didn't think the imagery was strong enough or the story wasn't compelling enough or you know, whatever. And I didn't have anybody to run the copy through to make sure it was okay. And all these people to approve and things. It's just that process would be difficult. But Oxford came to me and I met with Joe Blair, the president of the parent company for them, that they own Gitman Brothers shirts and several other companies as well, making different apparel. And I actually met with him at a hotel here in Dallas when we started talking about the project when he was here visiting with Neiman's to talk about selling more suits to them or, you know, one of their clients. And he's in from New York. And so I met with him and talked to him and we did a video and stills and they used that on the website and through some advertising and some other things. And then, of course, they were totally applicable for the book and the project. And so it was a perfect kind of marriage of, you know, a way to support me as a photographer and help create the book financially, but they get to use some of the imagery and they're featured in the book. So it's like everybody wins, I think. And so, but with them, they, you know, they do have a lot of pressures on them financially and economically, I think, these days, because it does take so much time to do what they do. And they're real reluctant to change the quality of it. They're not reluctant to change based on technology as long as they're not sacrificing the quality. And when we're there and we're working with it and working with the way that they make these suits, the one thing that really struck me about that is the amazing amount of detail that they hold in the way they line up the fabric. And that is how I figured out, that's how you decide if a piece of apparel is really well made. And you can look at the seams and how the fabric lines up in those seams. So like where the sleeve connects with the body of the suit. And if there's a pattern in that, you know, some kind of pinstriping or whatever that, you know, or just the pattern of the fabric, if it lines up and it's flush. And I mean, you know, you see some of the video and stuff from those, and the imagery from that is that really tight shot, those shots of them lining up that fabric to make sure that it touches, and it touches correctly and lines up. And a lot of people wouldn't even ever notice that. I wouldn't have noticed it before I went to their factory, but that's the kind of level of detail that they work toward. And even in the lapel, there's 1,000 hand stitches in each of the lapels, and the way they hand stitch it, it's a very time intensive process, and it's all actually done by hand by mostly women that are just sewing by hand these stitches, and the stitches are what make it fold. You know, the stitching between the outside and the inside liner and then what's in between, and just the way that they do that, that's what makes the lapel fall back like that and have that kind of fold.
Do you come away from a project like this unable to, like, ever go to Old Navy again and, you know, pick up 3 t-shirts for $25?
You know, it's funny. I guess I'd go back, and I talk about this story a little bit. It's a short story, but coming out of Lowe's, like, it was probably about 2009 or 10, I guess, my son was, I guess, maybe 8 years old, something like that. Mm-hmm. And we were coming out, and I was really interested because we walked out, and we walked to my truck to get in, and he looks down, he looks at the manhole cover on the ground, and it says Made in the USA. And he made a point, I mean, even at 8 years old, because he had been kind of around me talking about Made in America and seeing the book and imagery coming out. I mean, at that time, it was in its infancy. We had maybe 15 or 20 craftsman companies on the website. And even he noticed that. So it's just that perspective of, or that just awareness, I think, and in seeing that. And so that, I think that's an important part of all this as well, that this little story that I thought I'd share.
I had never thought until I opened up your book about who makes things like Academy Awards or Grammys, and I didn't, I guess I assumed that they sent out to some trophy company or something. Tell us about the Grammy Awards and how they actually get updated every few years and the design's slightly different.
Yeah, John Billings is the Grammy man, and he's in Colorado, in Ridgeway, Colorado, and he's been making them for a long time, and he kind of inherited the company from when he was working for the original German, I believe he was German he was German when he started working for him, and so he got the company from him, and when he was about to, I think he was passing away, going to pass away soon or something. So he promised him that he would continue the project of making them and try and hold on to that and not sell it off to some company to make them overseas or anything like that. And so, you know, John's had a difficult time trying to, you know, also keep up with the demand of them and keep, of course, the price point and everything and improve them. And, you know, I think he's had people come along and trying to outbid him or, you know, things throughout the years, and he's held on to them. And I think it's just because he's so devoted to it. And I hope they keep them with them as long as, you know, he'll keep making them, because he has that tradition, that history that I think is so important to something like that, especially, so that they can continue that that depth in that story of what he makes and that. And I think that's a real important part of that story of where those come from. You know, the alloy that he uses is called Grammium, and it's his own proprietary blend of different alloys that he's made and that he uses, and he buys that from a manufacturer here in the U.S. and melts it down and then makes them. And, you know, we were there for the day doing that over Christmas, actually, when I was on holiday there for Christmas visiting my family, and in Grand Junction. So we went down there and photographed him and the ski maker as well down there in Silverton a couple years before that.
Yeah, there are skis and there are also surfboards. And I didn't think about surfboards being made from wood underneath all of that beautiful lacquer and that sort of thing. But sure enough, wood is such a versatile material. That comes through in this book like never before. You can make it into anything.
Yeah, actually, I mean, the old surfboards were wood. The ones actually that they make now is some kind of it's like fiberglass or something so it's not really wood on the inside anymore. You know, I think to make them lighter and mm-hmm. things, you know, now it's almost like a foam type of thing that they cut and then sands down and smooths down and gives it the shape and everything. And that's the, the signature of, that surfboard maker style is kind of the everything from the sides and how molded the sides are and how the front might lift up more or more pointed or, whatever the design of that finished board is going to be. And Tim Bessel, we photographed in La Jolla, California. And, we would always try and find companies that were real indicative of that area. And so I was there traveling for a job for Titleist, photographing Bob Vokey for Titleist. He makes wedges for Titleist. And so just north of San Diego. And so we looked into it and I found Tim and I emailed him and just thought he would be a great addition. You know, what else are you going to photograph in Southern California besides a surfboard maker, right? So he, he makes surfboards every day. He goes to work and makes some surfboards and he goes and surfs himself. And so, I think that was an important part of kind of the selection process too, and making the book real diverse is also trying to find the companies that are real indicative of the area, like Louisiana, the accordion maker, yeah. that Zydeco kind of music. And I just thought that would be perfect. And he was really good too. And so it was interesting to always kind of look for those products that were indicative of that geographic area.
Photographer Tad Myers is my guest. His new book is called Portraits of the American Craftsman. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Tad Myers. His new book of photography is called Portraits of the American Craftsman. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Tad, I have to ask you, there is so much emphasis on things made in the United States, made carefully. What did it take to find a publisher who could print this book in the United States when people may not realize, but a lot of stuff, especially more expensive books like this, are published overseas now or printed overseas?
Right. Yeah. And, that was obviously a very important component of this whole process. It was in the contract. I made sure it was in the contract with that David put it in the contract with the publisher to make sure that it would be printed in the U.S. with U.S. paper. Because obviously, I told him that, I didn't want to be in the middle of signing books and someone says, well, why is your Great American Craftsman book printed in China or something, So I think there are ways to make that happen. I've thought about this a lot. And I think it's just a conscious effort by companies to make it happen. I mean, it is more expensive typically to do things or print books or do things in America because of our higher standard of living. Cost of people, cost of healthcare, cost of, everything. Because, the country here has really protected their employees and done things in a way that protect them both, you know, work environment and all that, and it all costs money. And you go overseas where there's less of those restrictions, then they can have kind of a lower price point on things, and labor is less expensive than anything. But the interesting thing to me is as the world market is now so much larger, obviously, with the with so many other countries being manufacturers, but a lot of those, some of those countries are coming up in value as far as labor costs and other costs of doing business. And so as they come up and we kind of, you know, hopefully don't go down, but, you know, we might have needed to come down a little bit from where we were, and we're having to compete globally. But the difference between the two is not as significant as it was 10 years ago. And with, you know, oil costs going up and shipping things overseas back over here, and the time. I mean, you know, these guys in Chicago, the book was printed in Chicago by Lake book producers, publishers, and they, you know, they can print that book in like 3 weeks, and they can have them to suppliers, you know, to the chain. And a lot of times a book like this would take at least 3-4 months to print overseas and get it over here. So, you know, it really allows a publisher or anybody to be much more nimble in the way that they order things, and they don't have to necessarily predict so much so far out for different products. And so I think that's one of the really large benefits to printing or, you know, manufacturing anything in the States, not to mention the economic and ethical parts that might be something else that people consider.
Are bookstores more reluctant to carry it if there's a more expensive base price and therefore their profit is lower, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's a price point in there, and you know that that will be prohibitive to selling them, and that's why we worked real hard. The publisher kept telling me that we could produce this book for $29.95, and I was just floored with the fact that they could do that, because, you know, it kind of kept growing. You know, it was originally only like, I don't think 180 pages, and it grew and grew to 250, and then I think it ended up about 288. So, you know, the designer that designed it kind of just kept making pages. And of course I would have been happy with a 500 page book, but you know, that's probably not really in the cards. So, but for them to produce this quality of book for that price point, I think is amazing, because, you know, you look at books today that are, you know, large format photographic based books like this that are high quality printing, offset printing and everything. And those books typically cost a lot more than this, I think, in my experiences.
Of course, some of the things in this book are amazing, but they really are for collectors or people who are quite wealthy. Like, I can admire a gorgeous pair of hand-sewn boots. It will never really be part of my, not just my finances, but psychologically, I couldn't pay $6,000 for a pair of hand-stitched boots.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, there is a certain component to that for sure, because it's, you know, the, I guess every craftsman in the book, you know, it's kind of, their price point probably changes as they get busier. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, one really funny story that I have to pass on real quick is, one of the companies I shot really at the early stages, I think it was the, Nakona told me about this, I believe, but there used to be a bootmaker, and this is kind of legend, I guess. I didn't know exactly his name, but he was in, I think, El Paso or somewhere in West Texas, and an old guy had been making boots, custom boots for people for years and years. And so he, when you would call him, because he didn't have internet or anything, this is years back, I don't know exactly when, but he would write your name on his blackboard with a chalk, and he'd say, you know, if we're about 3 years out, or, you know, whatever the time frame is, once I get going on your boots or have them finished, I'll call you. If you call me to check on them before I call you, I scratch you off the list. So, you know, I just love the, I don't know, just the ability for him to do that and to say, you know, I don't like pressure, you know, mm-hmm. I work on boots. So if timeline is deadline is your problem, you're going to have to go somewhere else. And I want to have the time to produce these boots for you.
Hats are another, they come up a couple times in the book, and I hadn't realized how much work can go into making a really amazing hat.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's two different hat makers in there, one from Chicago, Optimo Hats, and they're kind of more of a fedora, kind of traditional Chicago type gangster-like looking hat, you know, from the old days.
But now loved by hipsters everywhere.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And actually, I traded out for, and Graham Thompson is the owner of that and bought it from the original owner in there, and the stories in the book about that and how he bought the company from him to continue it. And Graham is a good friend of mine. He's an amazing individual, and I think he's just built that business into such an incredible business. And he's got two locations now. He's got a location in downtown Chicago I visited when I was there on a Craftsman Tools job about a year ago. I visited his store. It's more of like a retail store in downtown Chicago. And then kind of on the south side, he has his production facility, and he's actually, I believe, moving or already moved into a bigger facility and making to have more room from even the one that I was there visiting a few years ago. And, you know, he's making those fedoras, you know, out of beaver and in the Panama hats and things. And it's a true process. I mean, and he, what I love about him too, is he is actually one of the ones that makes the hats. I mean, he's intricately involved. And when you come in that store on a daily basis, he's almost always there, and he talks to clients. He will fit a hat. He'll steam out a hat. He'll, you know, help, you know, fit it if you come in and it's not fitting correctly. And you know, I think that kind of tangible part of him being connected to that process and to the company in that way, I think is really what people appreciate. And it gives the product so much more value and so much more interest.
Yeah. I guess a lot of people really treasure the idea that what they own can tell a story.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's a conversation point. I mean, you know, and that's why I think that gets back to kind of that emotional connection with it. And, you know, Nakona baseball gloves, I own four of them, and I've traded out for some of them. I try and trade out for anything I can, of course. But they gave, you know, they needed some imagery. I said, hey, here's some imagery, and let's figure out a way we can barter for, you know, I needed some baseball gloves, and my son's got a couple of killer gloves, you know, of course, for his baseball. And so, you know, those gloves are really nice, and it's a different mentality. You know, those gloves you take care of, you oil them after every season, and you care for them, and, you know, hopefully you pass them down to your kids, and then they maybe to their kids. And it's much less of that disposable kind of item that some of us get so used to doing, you know, that disposable mentality, which hopefully we as a society can kind of work towards at least lowering that kind of mentality, at least some, which has kind of come about in the last 15 or 20 years, I think.
And Nakona's interesting because they do things the way they've always done it, but they have evolved their designs based on changing, I guess, consumer demand, right? So people want a glove that already feels pretty broken in now, as opposed to, you know, my dad could tell stories of, you know, you wrap the ball and you put,
right,
you know, you put rubber bands around it or whatever they had to do back in the 50s or whatever.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, they've also found that, you know, the different materials make a huge difference, and, you know, positives and negatives. Cause I have a softball glove that's a large, like 13.5-inch softball glove that I use for playing softball, and it's made out of kangaroo, but, you know, it's very soft. And at first it was great because, you know, you're playing with it and it's soft right out of the box, and it worked really good. But I found over 3, 4, 5 years, I probably had it about 4 years, and it gets almost too soft. Mm-hmm. So you kind of learn that, you know, there is positive and negatives. That's why I'm sure the pros, if they use them, they probably have the ones that are maybe hybrid gloves where they're part cowhide and part kangaroo or something, where some of it's softer, but some of it's harder to hold its rigidity so that you don't have a super soft glove, because some of that, it does make a difference. But that's what they've done. You know, they've just kind of changed and evolved over the years, where, you know, maybe 20, 30 years ago, there was only cowhide maybe, and that's the only choice you had.
Maybe the lowest end item in the book that was still really interesting to see was these handmade brooms that I guess there was a time when everybody made their own brooms or went to somebody in town.
Yeah, and, you know, that the Henson Broom Shop in Kentucky, he, you know, his family generation kind of thing, you know, he makes brooms on a daily basis now, and he runs that general store there, and it's in this tiny little town. And you know, he was a athletic coach and teacher for a long time. He kind of did not get into that family business for a long time, and then he ended up getting into it when he talked to his father, I believe, about it, and he kind of wanted to retire, and it was a kind of a good business to go into for retirement and have something to do, but not physically, real demanding. And so he, when we were there that day, he made a couple of brooms for me, and I think that is a functional piece of art. I mean, I bought three of them that day, I think, from him. One of them, a real knobby, kind of real artistic looking broom. I mean, mm-hmm. It's finished really interesting. The broom corn that he made the end out of, was spun in a certain way, and it's a piece of art. I mean, it's on my wall. It's hanging on my wall in my house.
So you would never run that along a dirty floor?
No. And I did buy a couple of just utilitarian mm-hmm. brooms that I use, that we use around the house. But that one, it really literally is a functional piece of art. I mean, I hung it on the wall. And so I tried, throughout this process, I have a holster from Jim Hastings, a holster maker in Mississippi. He made me a holster while we were there because I asked him, I need to make a holster from beginning to end if you can. And so he said, sure. And at the end of the process, I said, well, what are you going to do with that? Because, are you going to sell? He said, no, I can't sell it because we rushed through it. It's not right. And I said, well, can I have it? And he said, well, yeah, sure. So I took it home and, I'm going to frame it and put it on the wall as well. And, in like a shadow box, because it is. They're all functional pieces of art, I think.
It made me sort of sad going through this book to think about the fact that we, for a lot of reasons, don't really celebrate shop class or home ec class anymore. And there's reasons that we need to focus on other things. But there are some skills that people might discover they had, or passions they might discover they had, if they were encouraged at a young age to make things.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like almost I was one of the last generations that kind of came out of that world, because I remember in seventh grade, I took shop class. I was a skateboarder, so I made a launch ramp, and my father helped me some, but I did it mostly in shop class. And so we had a great shop class. I was very fortunate to be in an area that had shop class, had the tools. I made several things, but that was the one thing I remember because I used it so much with my friends. And at the same time, I was taking a computer science class, and I kind of talk about this because it felt like that was kind of the turning point around mm-hmm. that time, because my computer science teacher is telling me, okay, well, everybody needs to know computers and everybody, because that's the next big thing. This is like, 1990, 1980, well, or late 80s, I guess, 88, something like that, 87, 88. And so, as she said, you need to know computers. That's the next generation. You're going to use your brain, not your hands. I mean, I seriously remember her talking about that in my shop class. That I think the mentality was changing at that time because it was becoming more technology based. And so a lot of those shop classes have gone for budgetary reasons. I mean, the first thing you chop is probably shop, which is sad. And there's some people trying to bring that back. But that's back then, that really gave especially boys or that were interested in that kind of thing, gave them an alternative to just education and the academic side of it all, and something you can make with your hands.
The new book by Tad Myers is called Portraits of the American Craftsman. Excuse me, I wasn't sure if I had the S in the right place. Portraits of the American Craftsman. The text in that book is by Eric Celeste. Tad, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.